Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's Financial Services and E-Commerce Practice Group, was recorded on Thursday, February 22, 2015, during a live telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members.
Good afternoon and welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group telephone conference call on whether the single point of entry strategy eliminates too big to fail. My name is Christian Corrigan and I'm the Director of Publications here at the Federalist Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call, and also that this call is being used for use as a podcast in the future. Today, we're pleased to welcome two experts from the American Enterprise Institute who are going to present their new paper on this topic. Our two experts are Paul Kupiec, who is a resident scholar at the American Enterprise Institute, and Peter J. Wallison, who is the Arthur Burns Fellow in Financial Policy Studies at AEI as well. One quick note. In the notice of the call and on the page on our website, you can find the link to not only the paper itself from AEI, but also some accompanying slides today that our speakers are going to be referring to. So if you haven't already, go to our website, click on the link for this page and bring that up, because that'll be helpful as our experts are discussing their presentation and the paper. So without any further ado, I want to go ahead and stop there and turn the floor over to Peter Wallison. The floor is yours.
Thanks very much, Christian, and thank you all for participating in this. It's going to be a very interesting event for us, certainly. We'll talk a little bit about this single point of entry idea, and then hopefully your questions will help us further elucidate what this is all about. In December of 2013, after consulting widely with public and private stakeholders and experts in bank regulation, the FDIC published a proposal for carrying out an orderly resolution of a systemically important bank without disrupting the financial markets. This was the so-called single point of entry, or SPOE strategy, S-P-O-E. According to the FDIC's release, and I'm quoting here, the SPOE strategy is intended to minimize market disruption by isolating the failure and associated losses in a SIFI. And of course, you know what SIFI is. It's a systemically important financial institution, and that is a word we will use throughout this presentation. The associated losses in a SIFI to the top tier holding company while maintaining operations at the subsidiary level. In other words, the idea underlying the SPOE strategy is to use the assets of the parent holding company to recapitalize a failing subsidiary bank so that it can be kept operating. This will supposedly prevent a disruption of the market, as occurred, for example, with Lehman Brothers, and such disruptive foreign actions as ring-fencing the bank's assets abroad. Judging from the praise the FDIC received in the commentary on the SPOE strategy, many sophisticated observers thought that the FDIC had developed a solution to the problem of banks that were too big to fail, that is, so large that their failure would cause disruption or instability in the financial system. If the FDIC had in fact achieved this, it would be a big success for the agency and for the Dodd-Frank Act. And it would be a big help for the nation's largest banks, which were fighting the idea in Congress that they should be broken up because they were too big to fail. Unfortunately, the praise may be premature. Our analysis suggests that there are serious holes in the SPOE strategy's legal foundation and in how it is supposed to be implemented. As a result, if we are really concerned that the failure of a large bank will trigger a wider financial crisis, Dodd-Frank has to be reopened, with changes made in the powers of the FDIC or the bankruptcy system to address this possibility. We don't have it now. Although the FDIC has not limited the SPOE strategy to banks, most observers have assumed that the FDIC's plan referred to the common structure in U.S. banking, which is a bank holding company, which sits at the top of a corporate group with a bank and other subsidiaries below it. Our paper assumes that this is the structure the FDIC had in mind, but it also makes sense to consider this case Because if the SPO strategy doesn't succeed in managing the failure of a large bank, then it does not end too big to fail, and it does not accomplish the central purpose of the Dodd-Frank Act, which was to prevent a disorderly failure of a major financial institution without a taxpayer bailout. As outlined by the FDIC, the SPO strategy would be applied when the Secretary of the Treasury is confronted by the possibility that a large bank will fail. I have sent around, or have asked to send around, some slides which I think will help you visualize what is happening here. And slide one is the one I'm referring to here. This is a failing bank before the SPO transaction. So if you look at that, you can see how that is. That is how things are in status quo before the SPO transaction. In order to avoid the consequences of that failure, the Secretary, as authorized by Title II of Dodd-Frank, will seize the bank holding company that is the top holding company in the group and appoint the FDIC as the holding company's receiver. That is pictured in slide two. The FDIC then immediately charters a bridge financial company and transfers to the bridge all the holding company's assets and secured liabilities, including the company's equity position in all its subsidiaries. The bridge then functions as the new holding company, and the FDIC appoints new management. All the old holding company's outstanding unsecured debt is left behind in the receivership. This leaves the new holding company free of unsecured debt and the owner of a failing bank that requires recapitalization. Finally, if the new holding company has sufficient assets to attract new credit, it borrows the necessary funds and downstreams them as equity to the failing bank. And that is pictured in slide three. That recapitalizes the bank, and the new holding company and the bank then continue the business that they were previously doing. It's all very neat, because the bank has been recapitalized and it has never failed. The shareholders and the unsecured creditors of the old holding companies have suffered all the losses, and the main purpose of the SPO strategy has been achieved. The bank has continued operating, and there has been no serious market disruption. This tidy solution is probably what persuaded many observers that the FDIC had made a real advance in addressing the problem of how to prevent a disruptive big bank failure without using taxpayer funds. However, there are some serious problems with this solution. First, where in Title II, or the Dodd-Frank Act generally, is the authority to recapitalize a failing bank with the assets of the bank's holding company? Title II seems to have been conceived by Congress as a liquidation mechanism for a failing financial institution. The name of the title, after all, is Orderly Liquidation Authority, not Orderly Resolution Authority. The Orderly Liquidation Authority was seen as an alternative to bankruptcy, which, in light of what happened after Lehman, was considered by Congress and others to be inherently disorderly. There are ideas about using existing or improved bankruptcy rules to deal with failing banks, but our paper does not cover these proposals. While Title II clearly contemplates that a top-tier holding company can be seized by the Secretary of the Treasury and turned over to the FDIC as receiver, it says nothing about using the assets of the top-tier holding company to protect the creditors of a subsidiary bank from suffering losses. To do that is to take the assets of one group of creditors and use them to assist another group, is quite a radical idea. And if this is what Congress intended, it would have to be pretty clearly outlined in the law. However, Title II, the Orderly Liquidation Authority, says nothing about such a step. Indeed, Title II says in two places that it does not apply to bank subsidiaries. The Dodd-Frank language gives the FDIC broad authority to liquidate a failing financial firm, but that's all. It does not contemplate the recapitalization of subsidiaries, especially bank subsidiaries. It appears that Congress had in mind that the FDIC would use its authority under the Federal Deposit Insurance Act to resolve the bank subsidiary. So immediately, the SPO strategy runs into what we consider to be a serious legal problem. But that's not all. The next legal problem with the SPO strategy is this. What is the source of the Secretary's authority to seize the holding company and appoint the FDIC as a receiver? According to the language of Title II, the Secretary can only seize a non-bank financial firm, that would be a holding company, that is in default or in danger of default. Thus, even assuming that the FDIC can overcome the legal challenge by shareholders and creditors of the company, that their property rights in the holding company can't be taken for the purpose of recapitalizing the subsidiary bank, the Secretary will have to demonstrate that the holding company itself was in default or in danger of default. The FDIC may have assumed that if a subsidiary bank is insolvent, its holding company will also be insolvent. But as Paul's presentation will show in a moment, this is not necessarily true. In fact, for the biggest banks and their holding companies, it is not true at all. All of them remain solvent even if they have to write off their entire investment in their largest bank subsidiary. So if the holding company is not in default or in danger of default, the SPO strategy cannot be employed for the largest banks. Still, there are some holding companies that will at least be in danger of default, and Title II contains language intended to clarify what that means. Unfortunately, it's ambiguous, leaving a lot of questions in doubt. Title II provides several definitions of in default or in danger of default, but all of them contain major ambiguities. This may sound like quibbling, but how these ambiguities are resolved will determine whether the losses in the bank will be suffered by the creditors of the holding company or the creditors of the bank. So as the bank begins to weaken, the ambiguity about whether the holding company can be seized by the secretary or not will become a key issue. If it looks like the holding company could become insolvent if the bank fails, it will not be able to attract any credit. On the other hand, if it looks as though the holding company will survive the bank's failure, the bank won't be able to attract any credit because its own creditors will be losers. The ambiguity about which set of creditors will be the losers could cause as much market disruption as the impending failure of the bank itself. And there's one final legal issue. As Paul will discuss in detail, the FDIC long ago realized that if the SPO strategy is to work, holding companies will need to have a lot of debt outstanding that can be left behind in the receivership. That increases the capitalization of the new bridge holding company and thus increases the likelihood that it will be able to attract sufficient private credit that can be downstreamed as equity to recapitalize the subsidiary bank. Even if the subsidiary bank is healthy, its holding company will be expected to raise new unsecured subordinated debt or maybe even equity. These funds can be held at the parent level, or alternatively, the funds could be downstreamed immediately as a loan to the subsidiary bank and then forgiven if the bank needs the additional capital in the future. Recently, the same idea was advanced by the Financial Stability Board, a large European group of central banks and bank regulators, of which the Treasury and the Fed are members, when it suggested that all banks or holding company groups should have sufficient subordinated debt outstanding so that it can be converted into equity at the appropriate moment to recapitalize a failing bank. The debt is given the name Total Loss Absorbing Capacity, or TLAC. Under the TLAC proposal, the debt would be prepositioned at the bank level, and the same thing could be required by the Fed as part of the living will idea, perhaps, or that if necessary, the debt can be used to recapitalize the subsidiary by converting it to equity at the bank level. But there are several big problems with this idea, too. If the debt is the direct debt of the bank and is converted by action of the bank's directors, it would probably be permissible. But if the debt has been downstreamed or forgiven by the holding company to recapitalize the bank, it could potentially be a violation of the directors, holding company directors' fiduciary obligations to the holding company's shareholders. If the shareholders believe that is not in the interest of the holding company, and they could well have that view, the directors of the holding company could be subject to legal liability. If by downstreaming the debt as equity in the bank or forgiving it, the holding company would be rendered insolvent, it would certainly create a major liability risk for the directors, and it is likely also to be treated as a fraudulent conveyance under state laws and the Federal Bankruptcy Act. Finally, if the downstreaming or forgiveness of the debt did not make the holding company insolvent or likely to be insolvent, then, as I mentioned earlier, the secretary could not seize the holding company under Title II, and the spoke strategy could not be employed. To summarize, then, there are severe legal obstacles to the use of the SPO strategy. First, using the assets of a holding company to recapitalize a subsidiary, especially a bank, isn't authorized by the language or intent of Title II. Second, even if that problem could be overcome, it seems clear, as Paul will show, that the holding companies of the largest banks could not be seized by the secretary under Title II, because the insolvency of their biggest bank subsidiary would not render the holding company in default or in danger of default. And it's the biggest banks we are really worried about. Third, even if the holding company might be in danger of default, the ambiguity of whether it will be seized by the secretary will create market disruption, because different groups of creditors will be affected depending on whether the secretary can or cannot seize the holding company. Fourth, even if the holding company has enough debt outstanding to recapitalize the subsidiary in a TLAC-style transaction, the directors of the holding company may not want to do so because that might subject them to lawsuits by the firm's shareholders and creditors. The conclusion then has to be that the only way to resolve a failing bank is still through the FDIC's powers under the Federal Deposit Insurance Act, which is exactly where we were before the Dodd-Frank Act was enacted. The FDIC, in turn, has only been able in the past to prevent market disruption by selling a sick bank to a healthy one. At this point, however, we recognize the deficiency of that policy. Today, we cannot imagine, as a matter of policy, selling Citibank, for example, to J.P. Morgan Chase. And no one can seriously argue that the FDIC, under current law, would be able to take over Citibank, break it up, and sell off the pieces without creating a great deal of market disruption. In the end, then, the SPO strategy does not solve the TBTF problem, the too big to fail problem, or accomplish the central idea of Dodd-Frank, which is to allow large banks to be resolved without taxpayer funds or severe market disruption. I now will turn the discussion over to my colleague, Paul Kupiec, who has some really interesting things to report.
Thanks, Peter. I'm going to address two issues here. I'm going to take a look at the numbers and ask, could the SPO be used if one of the largest depository institutions failed? We're going to look at the numbers there and see if the holding company would be in default or danger of default. And then I'm going to turn to a second question and say, there are cases in which if a large depository institution failed, it likely would cause its holding company to be in default or danger of default. And I'm going to take a look at what happens when SPO is used in that setting compared to what would happen in an FDIC resolution in that setting. So first, I'd like you to take a look at, if you could, on page 21, Table 2. Table 2 on page 21 on the left column lists the 20 largest depository institutions in the United States. These are the banks, the separately incorporated chartered banks. On the right-hand column is the holding company that owns those banks. So you can see in the first row there, J.P. Morgan Chase National Association is the bank, and it's owned by J.P. Morgan Chase and Company, and so on. Now, it is these largest banking institutions which are potentially create the largest systemic risks should they become in danger of default, and it's these institutions that presumably Dodd-Frank was enacted to prevent their failure from causing a market disruption. So if any of these large depository institutions were to fail, were to lose their equity capital, lose losses that exhausted their equity capital, could we use SPO, could the Secretary of Treasury invoke orderly liquidation authority and use a single point of entry strategy to resolve these banks? So the first thought experiment we're going to do, if you take a look at page 22, table 3, is we're going to look at the 15 largest bank holding companies and do the following thought experiment. If those holding companies, if the largest their largest bank subsidiary were to suffer losses that were entirely to eat up their equity, would that loss that's imposed on the bank holding company cause the holding company to be in default or in danger of default? And so what we do is we get the equity in the bank, in the parent holding company, and we subtract from it the equity in the largest bank subsidiary, and you get the last column in table 3. And if you look down the last column in table 3, there's only one bank holding company that would be in danger of default if its largest bank subsidiary were to suffer a loss that exhausted its equity capital, and that would be TD Bank U.S. Holding Company, which generally wouldn't probably make your list of the most systemically important institutions. All the other institutions in the list, the very biggest, would all have a significant positive equity remaining in the holding company. If the Secretary of Treasury were particularly aggressive in interpreting default or danger of default, you might argue that he might claim that U.S. Bank Corporation or maybe State Street might be in danger of default, but that would be a stretch. They still have over $1.5 billion remaining in equity capital after they lost the equity in their largest depository institution. So essentially the story here is, in order to use orderly liquidation authority and a single point of entry strategy for any of these large bank holding companies, the holding company would have to suffer massive losses in many of its large subsidiaries in order for it to be in default or danger of default. So if its largest depository institution alone were to become in trouble, that alone would not allow the Secretary of Treasury to invoke orderly liquidation authority and use the single point of entry strategy. So for the largest institutions, you really need a calamity of errors and losses to invoke OLA. We're going to turn our attention now to a number of large institutions for which they own a single bank, and the bank is very large and comprises most of the assets of the holding company. And in these cases, the failure of the largest bank could imperil the bank holding company. And so what we're going to do here in table 4 on page 23, this is a list of the large bank holding companies that have a single bank subsidiary. They only have one bank subsidiary. And for these holding companies, all of them but Goldman Sachs and BBVA, which I can't calculate because it's a foreign, I don't have information on. But Goldman Sachs is the only one of these institutions for which the bank is not a very large part of the holding company. So for all the other holding companies here besides Goldman Sachs, the depository institution is the single largest asset that these holding companies have. And if that depository institution were to get in trouble, were to have losses that were to create distress for it, then it is clearly the case that these holding companies might be in danger of default, and they could be candidates for the use of orderly liquidation authority and a single point of entry liquidation strategy. So we're going to look at the consequences of invoking OLA and the SPO approach for these institutions. So the first line of loss bearing capacity in these institutions is the equity capital. So if you turn to table 5 on page 25, we have calculated the equity capital position of the holding company and the equity in the subsidiary bank. And in these cases, you can see if you compare the first two columns, for every bank except for Goldman Sachs, the equity in the depository bank is about the same size as the equity in the holding company, which means that if the depository institution were to suffer a loss that wiped out its equity, most of the equity in the holding company would also be wiped out. In some cases, the holding company would have no equity. In some cases, it would have a small residual amount of equity left. But in all of those cases, except Goldman Sachs, the Treasury Secretary would be able to make a case that should the bank suffer losses equal to its equity capital, the holding company would be in default, in danger of default, and they could invoke OLA and use a single point of entry resolution strategy. So once equity is exhausted, the next line of creditors that bears losses are the bank, note, and debenture holders. And if you turn to page 26, table 7, we take a look at we compare the liabilities of the holding company and the liabilities of the bank. And so within these structures, banks issue subordinated debt and notes, and the holding company issues subordinated debt and notes. And the comparison here is which of those institutions issues a larger amount of debt that could be potentially a candidate to absorb losses. And what you can see in Table 7 is for most of these institutions, all of them except Goldman or Ally, most of the liabilities of the institutions, the liabilities that could absorb losses, are really issued at the bank level. So there's much larger loss-absorbing capacity among the non-guaranteed debt at the bank rather than the holding company. So now this sets up the next sort of thought experiment. What would happen if we used a Dodd-Frank SPO orderly single point of entry resolution versus an FDIC resolution in the case of any of these depository institutions suffering losses equal to their equity? Well, under SPO, the bank holding company equity and the bank holding company unsecured debt suffer losses, but the holding company could also have loaned money to its subsidiaries. And so any money that it loans to its subsidiaries can't absorb losses, so we have to subtract that out. So the loss-bearing capacity under a SPO single point of entry resolution is the bank holding company equity plus any unsecured debt that the holding company has issued less any debt that it owes to its subsidiaries. So that's potentially the losses that could be borne by the parent if under a SPO orderly liquidation. Under a deposit insurance resolution, however, the FDIC seizes the bank subsidiary. All of the deposits are generally protected in the case of a large bank resolution. And so the loss-bearing capacity in a FDIC resolution before there's made any use of the deposit insurance fund is the bank equity plus the bank's unsecured debt. So if we go to page 27 and table 8, you can compare the maximum resources that are available to absorb losses before going to any government safety net in the two alternative approaches to fixing distress of a large depository institution in these cases. In the middle column are the maximum resources that are available at the holding company in a SPO resolution to absorb losses, and in the far right column are the maximum resources that are available to absorb losses in an FDIC resolution where the bank goes through resolution and the holding company either lives on to live another day or else goes into the normal bankruptcy process. So what you can see by comparing the two columns in Table 8 is there's far more capacity to bear losses in an FDIC resolution than there is for these institutions in a SPO resolution. So for these very large SIFI institutions where the failure of the large bank could cause the failure or the bankruptcy or in danger of bankruptcy of the holding company, and the SPO might be used. If the SPO were to be used, you would protect a very large amount of liabilities at the bank. The far right column in Table 8, all of those liabilities at the bank would be fully protected in a SPO resolution, and the losses would be imposed on the bank holding company liability holders and equity holders, which is a much smaller amount. If the losses at the bank exceed the loss-bearing capacity at the holding company, then they would be imposed on the orderly liquidation fund. They would be borrowed from the orderly liquidation fund, and the FDIC would assess all the other SIFIs in the economy to repay those losses over time. And so you can see that the SPO protects all bank debt, and it essentially reinforces the bank too big to fail problem. So if investors at the time of trouble think that the bank is going to be fully protected, then they're going to be quite happy to lend to the bank and be fully protected, and the holding company is not going to be able to raise money in times of crisis. If there's uncertainty about whether the SPO would be invoked and the bank might go into resolution, then the bank is not going to be able to raise any money. Now, this is not just an academic exercise. In the case of WaMu failure, JP Morgan bought the bank, and the bank's bondholders are expected to get a recovery of somewhere around 25% or 30%. Once the bank was seized, the holding company went into bankruptcy, but the bondholders of the holding company recovered fully 100%. And so in the normal resolution process, the holding company bondholders may expect to get significant recoveries, whereas the bank uninsured debt holders would bear significant losses. That situation is reversed 100% in a SPO resolution. If WaMu were done today in a SPO resolution, the holding company would have lost everything. The bank's notes and debentures would have been fully protected, and the orderly liquidation fund would have had to put forward about $7.5 billion to fund the resolution, which would then have been collected from other firms in the industry subsequently. So this issue here, so in summary, these, if you go through the numbers and you look at it, OLA and the SPO strategy does not end too big to fail for the large depository institutions. For the largest institutions, if the depository institution were to suffer significant losses that would require it to be put in resolution, the holding company would not in general be in default or danger of default, and the OLA and the SPO could not be used. The bank would have to go into an FDIC resolution, and as Peter mentioned, when a large bank goes into an FDIC resolution, the only alternative the FDIC has come up with to date is to sell a large failed bank to another larger healthy institution and create a yet larger too big to fail bank. And so that problem has not been solved by OLA and Dodd-Frank. In other cases where the default of the bank would cause the holding company to default, there are not enough resources at the holding company to recapitalize the bank. There are many more resources in a bank resolution before the government safety net gets invoked. And so, as Peter mentioned, the regulators have recognized this problem. And while domestic rules have not yet been proposed, the international rules have been proposed through the Financial Stability Board in their so-called TLAC proposal of last November, where they're now arguing that large, systemically important financial institutions must not only have minimum capital requirements, they're going to have minimum debt issuance requirements, and so that this debt can be foreclosed upon and absorb the losses should any of the subsidiaries become in danger and causing market distress. So the U.S. regulators have not issued TLAC rules, and some have suggested that if these TLAC rules were issued in a way, there could be some legal form of art here, where if the TLAC rules were issued in exactly the right way, that a holding company were to issue subordinated debt and turn around and relend the funds to its subsidiaries in just the right amount, that should the subsidiaries get in trouble, the holding company could forgive the debt to its subsidiaries and sort of fix the problem. But as Peter has mentioned, if this is not in the interest of the holding company, blindly and unwantingly forgiving the debt of a subsidiary that damages the shareholders of the holding company would be grounds for massive lawsuits and would be done at the director's own peril, I would think. It's certainly not is not a settled item. So just to summarize before we go for questions, we believe there's a strong legal case that Dodd-Frank does not permit the use of the orderly liquidation authority or the single point of entry for banks. It's not supposed to be used to aid the deposit insurance fund, and yet none of these issues have been discussed in the FDIC single point of entry outline for their strategy. The SPO shifts losses from the bank debt to the bank holding company debt holders. The SPO will fully protect the bank debt from loss. This is going to reinforce the too big to fail problem, and in our view, it creates property rights issues and governance issues at the holding company level. The criteria to use the OLA, the criteria in the law is very broad and ambiguous, and this is going to create massive uncertainty in the next financial crisis when investors are uncertain about who will be left holding the loss bag and basically will pull away and not fund anybody since they won't know where the losses are going to end up. And these proposals to downstream so-called TLAC into the subsidiaries and massage them in a way that might comply with law are really just a form of the so-called contingent capital or COCOs that are being used in Europe. And it's really a new capital regime, and it's really not a way to implement a resolution or a liquidation. It's just an entirely new overlay capital regime, if that's the form it takes. So thank you very much, and we look forward to your questions.
All right. In a moment, you will hear a prompt that will say the floor mode is on, and after that, press star and the pound key to get in the queue to ask a question. I want to do one quick programming note before we go to questions. We just booked our next scheduled teleforum conference call for 1 p.m. tomorrow, and that is going to be a special courthouse steps teleforum on the Supreme Court's recent decision in Holt v. Hobbs. So, again, that's 1 p.m. tomorrow afternoon, Eastern. All right, looks like we had our first question, and we'll go to.
Hello. Thank you very much for those interesting presentations. I'm John McGinnis at Northwestern Law School, and I'd just like to step back for a moment and look at this proposal in historical terms, and not the question of whether there is statutory authority, but if, for instance, there were an amendment to give the FDIC this kind of statutory authority, would it be a good idea? And what it reminds me of a little is that many years ago, before the Great Depression, bank shareholders were actually liable for twice the amount that they had invested in the banks. This is a way of trying to make banks less fragile. In some sense, one could think of it as a breach in the corporate veil, limited liability. And to some extent, this seems to be the same thing, limited, of course, to bank holding companies. Could you comment on whether just this is like that in some respect, and also whether we should be moving, even if this isn't the right exact proposal, to something which requires shareholders, or perhaps the largest shareholders like bank holding companies, to support the banks?
Yes, thanks very much for that question. It is it has some similarities to double liability. it's not exactly the same thing, because here the shareholders have liability up to their invested equity into the holding company, which under the TLAC idea, which may exceed their equity investment in the bank. So right there, it kind of violates the corporate fail of the depository institution, their losses being limited to their investment in the depository institution. So we think that's an issue. So we're not of the mind that the Fed's source of strength doctrine allows the regulators to require the bank holding company shareholders to lose anything more than their investment in the depository institution. Some interpret the source of strength doctrine as allowing the Federal Reserve to require the holding company shareholders to lose more than their investment in the depository institution. But there is nobody that I'm aware of that ever says that they should be required to lose more than their investment in the holding company itself. And under double liability, the shareholders, as you know, could lose twice what was par value back then in some states. And actually, some states I even think had more than that. Some states thought it was a great idea, and they'd make it like three or four times par value. But that was all actually turned out to be the Congress decided a pretty bad idea in the 1930s. What happens was when equity gets traded, as it does in the United States, and ownership and is separated from management, that you find owners all over the place, like in pension funds and mutual funds and 401ks, and all of a sudden, if they're having double liability, they have to pony up money because their mutual fund or pension fund owned shares in a bank. And you could see how in a modern capital market, the idea of double liability leads to a lot of trouble very quickly. And so the TLAC proposal is, in a sense, it's the way it's related to double liability is the authorities are basically saying, we're going to force you to have uninsured debt that could bear losses equal to the size of your equity position. So you're going to have, say, equity equal to 8%, then you have to have 8% of it's risk-weighted assets, actually, 8% of risk-weighted assets. So you'd have to have another 8% of risk-weighted assets that you issue in subordinated debt that could bear losses. And those would be different owners than the shareholders. So again, we're separating where the losses go from the equity. But to the extent that some interpret the source of strength doctrine as allowing the Federal Reserve to require holding company shareholders to lose more than their investment in the subsidiary, and it would only that violates the corporate separation here, but the maximum they would ever be able to impose on them would be the equity in the holding company. And in some cases, that's not much different. In other cases, it's quite a bit different, as you saw in the tables. Peter?
I would just add there that this source of strength issue is something that anyone who looks at this issue is going to hear a lot about, because in Dodd-Frank, Section 616 of Dodd-Frank is said to have codified the source of strength doctrine. And however, if you look at the language there, it doesn't say anything about what Paul was just discussing. It does not say, it certainly does not say, that the parent company has to cause itself to become insolvent in being a source of strength for the subsidiary. And there's a tremendous amount of difference between simply providing support for the subsidiary, managerial and financial support, and turning your company into a bankrupt entity in order to support the subsidiary. And Paul made exactly the right point, and that is, how could we possibly have a situation like that in a world in which ownership of holding companies is changing every day?
All right. Well, if you'd like to ask a question, our lines are open, so press star and then the pound key.
Well, it looks like we've got a bit of a quiet audience right now. I don't know if there's anything else that the two of you'd like to cover while we give our audience a couple more minutes to think up a question or two.
Well, I guess on a personal level, Paul and I have been simply astonished that the FDIC would propose something that has so many very serious weaknesses. Paul was the head of research, economic research at the FDIC, and also was a Fed economist at one point. We've both seen the government from the inside, but this was kind of shocking that something that seems so unsupported in the law and so unworkable in the numbers, as Paul made so clear, would actually get out of the FDIC and then be praised by many of the so-called pundits in this business. I mean, it's pretty remarkable. This has not, as far as we know, we are the first two people who have actually criticized the SPO idea as unworkable. There have been a lot of writing about SPO, but most of it has been to support it and state that it is a great idea and the sort of thing that ought to be done. And yet we couldn't imagine how people could have come to this conclusion.
Well, let's do. We still have about 10 minutes. Let's do a last call for questions. While those of you out there are thinking up some, press star and then the pound key. But looks like we did have one or a couple of questions just jump on the line. So great, we'll go right to them.
Peter, this is Jack Park. Your last comment raises a question. You've kind of been alone in fighting the narrative with respect to the 2008 and follow-on problems and their causation. What do you attribute the difference to? What do you attribute the difference between your views and the narrative and the reception for the SPOE proposal?
Well, that's an interesting question. First of all, the SPOE and the whole Dodd-Frank system is based on a narrative that assumes that the financial crisis in 2008 was caused by insufficient regulation of the financial system. That it was basically a problem of Wall Street being out of control and taking too much risk, and we had to control it. And of course, we call it Dodd-Frank, but it's the Dodd-Frank Consumer Protection and Wall Street Reform Act is its formal name. And so, under those circumstances, the FDIC was given tremendous amount of authority to address the resolution of these very large non-bank financial institutions, and it has had very little experience as this legislation was rushed through Congress. The FDIC itself has had very little experience dealing with the difference between a bank holding company and a bank. The FDIC has only dealt with banks.
And only successfully really resolved small banks. Once a bank gets of any size at all, they have great difficulty in the resolution process. For example, IndyMac, which was about a $30 billion institution, was generally viewed as a pretty big black eye for the FDIC during the crisis. They had deposit runs because they couldn't make insurance determinations. Then they ended up getting were the first people sued for robo-signing, by the way. The IndyMac running under their watch was involved in the robo-signing scandal. So, I mean, there wasn't this great sort of report card when it comes to them resolving large institutions. And so the whole Dodd-Frank was kind of a wish almost that somehow this would work out. But there's very little experience as Peter said, and kind of a rush to legislate. And this is what we ended up with, I think.
Yeah, and just to add one more point to that, they had to have some sort of resolution mechanism because the whole financial crisis was blamed on the risk-taking of the private sector and the fact that when Lehman was allowed to fail, it caused this huge calamity. So they had to have a resolution process, and I'm sure no one could think of any other organization that might be able to do the resolution except for the FDIC. And the FDIC has had no experience in that area. So that is probably what accounts for they're putting out this plan that is really very incomplete and doesn't seem to have a full understanding of what they have been asked to do.
Thank you.
This is Dr. Christian Corrigan. As was mentioned, I want to add that Peter Wallison with us on the call also has a new book out called Hidden in Plain Sight, What Really Caused the World's Worst Financial Crisis and Why It Could Happen Again, that was released this month, I believe, and it's available on Amazon.com and in bookstores. So another piece of reading material to check out. We've got about 9 minutes left, and looks like we have one more question on the line.
Well, good afternoon, gentlemen. Great presentation. I really appreciate the thoughts you put into this. I know you focused especially on the financial implications of the language, and my question is a little bit shifting towards the political. How do we get out of this? What is the likelihood that there will be a will to amend the language or to repeal substantially everything that needs to be repealed in it to be able to function without these anomalies?
Well, that's why I wrote this book that Christian mentioned, the Hidden in Plain Sight, what actually caused the world's worst financial crisis and why it could happen again. Because, in fact, we have not solved the problem that caused the financial crisis. And the book is very clear about the fact that the financial crisis was actually caused by government housing policy and not by lack of regulation of Wall Street. I wrote the book in order to start the process of debating the underlying reasons for the Dodd-Frank Act, because as I mentioned before, the Dodd-Frank Act is based on the idea that it was Wall Street and the risks taken by Wall Street that caused the crisis. It's not true. And so if the only way we will get out of this, as you ask, and legitimately ask, the only way we will get out of this situation with Dodd-Frank is for the American people and their representatives to understand that Dodd-Frank is, if I may use the term, illegitimate. It was adopted on the basis of a narrative that was false. And as long as that is true, this is not legislation that we ought to continue to have on the books in the United States. So I'm glad you asked that question. You've gone right to the heart of what I had in mind when I spent all the time writing this book. And if you all want to take a look at the book, you can find it, as is said, in bookstores and on Amazon. And in a few weeks, I'm going to do a teleforum on the book. So that's another point that we can have a chance to discuss what's in this book.
Thank you.
Let me add a little bit. But as you know, I guess there's two potential avenues that of trying to address some of these problems. One is there are folks who would say repeal the whole lot. Politically, whether that's possible or not, I think is subject to debate. And there's others that would prefer to reform it as they can improve it and deal with fix the worst of it and over time. The problem with that is, though, every time, as you can well tell by reading the newspapers now, anybody introduces something to fix a problem in the law, they're vilified as Wall Street lovers and bought off by the big banks. And and the level of political rhetoric around the small changes that have been made thus far, which are really technical changes and really don't have much to do with changing the risk exposure of anything. It's really trying to fix some big problems that were written into the law because it was written in haste. The CLOs I'm talking about and the swaps pushout, neither of which had any huge implication for risk shifting or government support, but you see the noise that gets generated. So even, you know, fixing things that are really are problematic, this political the dynamic here makes it tough to move forward on this, as you can see.
All right. Well, we have just a couple minutes left, so we'll take one more last call for questions. If anyone has one more that they would like to get in before we conclude the call, press star and then the pound key. All right. Well, it looks like we've exhausted the questions and nearly exhausted our time. So, on behalf of the Federalist Society, I want to thank both of our experts for joining us today. If you haven't already had a chance to check out their paper, again, you can find it, the link to it on our website. Also, as mentioned previously, Peter Wallison's book, Hidden in Plain Sight, which we're going to have more programming on here at the Federalist Society in the next few weeks. So until then, just a reminder that our next Teleform conference call has been scheduled for tomorrow at 1 p.m. Eastern on the Supreme Court's recent decision in Holt v. Hobbs. So until then, thank you all for joining us, and we're adjourned.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at federalistsociety.org/multimedia.